Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
992 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 43 seconds, 41 seconds, 39 seconds, 37 seconds, till George W. Bush leaves office, barring impeachment. Welcome back, my friends. Coming up on today's program, Jeffrey Feldman will be here in the second hour with a new frame. Need a girlfriend, Congressman? A GOP graft investigation uncovers prostitutes, limousines, and hotel suites. In the third hour of our program, Larry Scott of EA Watchdog will be with us. Our question for this hour, is the economy here to serve society, or is society here to serve the economy? Wayne Cruz is with us, Vice President for Policy and Director of Technology Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, their website, cei.org. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Is the economy here to serve society, or are we here to serve the economy?
Well, we're here to take part in it. You know, you just mentioned that that countdown. That's about how long this antitrust case has been going on with Microsoft and the EU and the competitors.
Right, which is the topic that brings us together. Yeah, you've written this piece about Microsoft and the European Union. The European Union is saying to Microsoft, hey, wait a minute, you're putting out of business small companies and medium-sized companies that would have otherwise developed things like for example, a media player,
right,
or a little WordPad program, or a fax interface, or whatever. Yeah. By bundling these things in with the operating system, and you have a monopoly on the operating system market, and frankly, I think the Europeans are going after them for the monopoly on the operating system market as well. They're suggesting that Microsoft has been behaving in a way that is anti-competitive. And what's your problem with that?
Well, it's not surprising that people are worried about that. But remember, you would have had to invent something like an Internet to make it be as easy to get the competitive products to Microsoft. A lot of the issue is over Microsoft bundling the media player in. And one of the main complainants is RealPlayer, whose share has actually gone up. But the main media player that's been growing is not even a party to this case at all, and that's the Music Match media player that a lot of people are downloading and using, lets you burn CDs and watch videos and all that sort of thing. So that's one of the key problems you have with antitrust. You were asking about the economy serving the public or people serving the economy. One thing that antitrust does do is it does allow competitors to have an extra arsenal, an extra arrow in the quiver, I guess, to go after rivals like Microsoft, if they can't go after them on price or quantity or something, or quality or service.
Well, you know, there's a fundamental question here, Wayne, that I think that we need to at least have a discussion about in the United States, and we really haven't had a discussion about in this country, at least since the Nixon years. Well, I'd say Jimmy Carter, actually. Jimmy Carter was the last guy to bust up a big corporation. He busted up AT&T, and Jerry Ford initiated that.
Remember, that's a different case, though. Remember, AT&T had a government-granted monopoly, and that's even the root of the term. Monopoly is a grant by a monarch. We don't have those today. We may have big firms
under
free market capitalism.
NFL has exemptions from antitrust laws. The National Football League.
Oh yeah. Well, you do have exemptions like that. But I mean, generally, in the typical goods and services economy, we don't rely on the government grants of monopoly for electricity and things like that. Or we should do so less. There's monopoly power.
Well, but the reality is, Wayne, I mean, you know, you want to talk about
electricity.
Operating
systems certainly are not in that category.
Well, again, back to the larger question here. At what point do we the people say that the inevitable practice of capitalism, as defined not just by Karl Marx but by Adam Smith as well, you know, and Adam Smith railed about this in Wealth of Nations, about how corporations would attempt to gain competitive advantage by monopolizing markets.
By teaming up with government, that was his.
Well, that was one of his concerns. The other concern was that they would do it by teaming up with each other, by collusion.
Well, and remember, though,
and
that's
David,
not what's happening here. This is the competitors colluding themselves against Microsoft. It's a kind of collusion going on, but not in the way that you mean. Remember, Microsoft or companies like it, you know, you could argue that Google is on the Internet what Microsoft was on the desktop. As big as companies get, you have to remember that they're never as big as the rest of the competitive economy that's arrayed against them.
But Wayne Cruz, the question that I'm trying to get to, I still haven't gotten this thing out, and that is, at what point do we say, okay, you're big enough? You know, there was a time when Ohio said to John Rockefeller, sorry, what you're doing is illegal. You are too big. You're driving small companies out of business. And he was. He was colluding with the
government. You don't ever say that, because what you're talking about then is a coercive government that then breaks up what is essentially a voluntary business organization that can already be disciplined in the competitive market. And that's what is happening with Microsoft, handheld devices, and with Google's competition.
Right, I understand. So you're suggesting then that government by its existence, if it participates in the marketplace, is coercive?
Of course, if it's regulating. I mean, government.
Okay, then here's the question for you, Wayne. How do you have a marketplace without a government? The government defines what is private property. The government defines what's an intellectual property, what isn't. The government provides courts to enforce those contracts.
Exactly.
The government allows corporations to exist. The government provides police departments to enforce those contracts.
Is limited government. That's what you're defining, and that's a good thing, and that's the purpose.
No, what I'm defining is a very aggressive, active government. There are no negative rights here. These are all positive rights. They all require government to enforce. Even the rights against government sticking their nose in our business have to be enforced by government.
If you're defining a government that is protecting property rights and enforcing contracts and things of that sort, that's a perfectly legitimate function. What you're talking about with the Microsoft case, though, is government picking a business model, saying, okay, well, we have this computer service, and now we're going to go in and break it up and
share the intellectual
property. No, I'm not.
What I'm saying is that business is a game. I mean, I think we can both agree on this. Business is, you know, it's not unlike baseball, right? You have a baseball diamond. There's an infrastructure. The infrastructure for business is the legal infrastructure and you know, whatever physical facilities they need to conduct
their
business.
But a baseball game is a zero-sum game. The purpose of business and the reason for an institution like capitalism is so important is because it creates wealth. It adds to the pie. It adds to the pie that gets bigger and bigger. If we try to break up certain kinds of business models, we already have an open source business model in software. It doesn't serve any purpose to decrease competition by forcing Microsoft to become that kind of model too.
But you are when government comes in and says, okay, we're going to define the rules of the game, and the rules of the game, and this, by the way, you know, Herbert Hoover and Teddy Roosevelt, these Republicans were big fans of this stuff. We're going to define the rules of the game, and the rules of the game are going to be that you can't get so large impossible for small companies to enter the market.
You drive
across the United States right now, Wayne, we're talking with Wayne Cruz, CEI.org, the website. Wayne, you drive across America right now, you go into any small town, and you're not going to see locally owned businesses anymore.
Of course you do.
They're being wiped out.
You have more mom and pops in an era of big box stores than you ever did. What you want is not to put the brakes on capitalism, but to recognize we don't have near the bandwidth we need, just for example, in terms of telecommunications and computers. We need companies and ventures and mergers that are way beyond anything we have now. We want Microsoft to be an average-sized company of the future.
So you think it's just a fine thing, for example, that a defense contractor owns the largest purveyor of news in the United States?
Purveyor of what? I'm sorry.
News. General Electric, NBC.
Right, okay.
You think that's okay?
Well, I think, especially in a competitive world where we have YouTube and all of these other wacky Internet sites and people generating news and sources on their own, Drudge Report and all the spinoffs and all the ones that are to come, I don't care as long as we don't live in a society that practices censorship.
So in essence, what you're suggesting,
one particular owner, no.
What you're suggesting is this kind of fundamentalist religion that the market will always do the greatest good for society if it's completely unregulated. If that's the case, how do you account for Love Canal?
No, there's no such thing as no regulation. The question is whether it makes sense in most contexts to have competitive discipline or whether to have political discipline.
And yet the fact of the matter is, if I run a business...
There's no way you trust the crowd in Washington. I don't either.
No, if I run a business, my first imperative is to make as much money as I possibly can. And if the way to do that is to crush my competitors or buy out my competitors and end up being the only company in the market, I'm going to try and do that. That is the nature of capitalism. And the only thing that's going to constrain that is the force of government. Historically, that's what we've seen.
Government facilitates that kind of behavior, doesn't constrain it. As long as you have free capital markets, which we do, we have a stock market, we have advertisers who can flee, reporters, workers.
So we're down to four oil companies now, Wayne.
That is what will discipline that kind of behavior.
Those four oil companies have closed 55 refineries in the United States in the last 10 years.
Sorry?
The four oil companies that now dominate our the landscape here have closed 55 refineries in the United States in the last 10 years. Last year, George Bush offered them a free Air Force base to build a refinery with no environmental regulations, and they said, no thanks. They're limiting the supply of gasoline. The price is going through the roof. That's fine with
you. There's so many restrictions on the production of fuel in this economy. I mean, that's a whole different topic. We'd love to talk to you about that, too. There are plenty of environmental restrictions and other restrictions on the ability to create energy. So, most folks who are worried about energy shortages, things like that, ought to be happy about rising prices, and I'm not. I mean, that's an important issue, but boy,
okay.
Let's have another session on that.
We will. Wayne Cruz, Vice President for Policy, Director of Technology Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Good talking
to you,
Wayne.
You're a lot of fun, by the way. I'd like to come back.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour. Do good.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's a beautiful day.
And welcome back. You're light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me. Americans spend a lot and still suffer a lot. Could this have something to do with the aggregation of very, very large companies in the health insurance business? An interesting juxtaposition of stories here today. Again, back to this question of, is the economy here to serve society, or is society here to serve the economy? And I'm of the opinion that the economy is here to serve society, to paraphrase Sir John Goldsmith, who died one of the richest men in the world and wrote a brilliant book called The Trap, about the trap of thinking that the economy should that humans are here to serve the economy. Here's the story. This in today's, New York Times, a day or two ago, Robert Pear's article. Federal investigators have found that a handful of companies account for a growing share of the health insurance policies sold to small businesses in most states, leaving consumers with fewer options and higher costs. The Government Accountability Office, an investigative arm of Congress, said that the largest insurer had 43% of the market for small group coverage in a typical state, up from 33% in 2002. In nine states, the largest carrier had more than 50% of the market share. Small businesses, again, Robert Pear's piece in the New York Times, small businesses and doctors also report a steep decline in competition in health insurance markets. And what's the consequence of this? The price is going through the roof. The company's getting richer and richer. You look at the oil companies. The oil companies, Peter DeFazio, Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, I was speaking with him this morning, and he pointed out that in the last 10 years, 55 refineries have been taken offline by the oil companies in the United States. And the government has said, you don't have to take these things offline. And they're like, no, we don't need them. In fact, George W. Bush last year offered an Air Force base in California to any of the oil companies for free. He said, you want to build a refinery? We will give you this unused Air Force base for free, and we will waive all environmental rules. None of the oil companies wanted to take him up on it. Chuck Schumer now out there saying that the oil companies typically operate at 85% of capacity during the winter in terms of refining oil into gasoline, and then kick up to 95% in the summer because there's increased demand. This year, they're still operating at 85%. Thus, the price of oil, of gasoline going through the roof. Oil company profits at record highs. ExxonMobil recently showed a profit that was the largest profit in the history of the planet. Since then, there have been a few others. So we see it in oil. We see monopolies forming. We see it in health insurance. An article in today's Wall Street Journal, actually, about how one of the health insurance companies just paid their CEO $1.6 billion. And two members of the board were reelected. They were on the compensation committee. They got reelected, but the stockholders withheld 20% of their votes. It was the stockholders' way of saying, we're going to gently tap your wrist because the Wall Street Journal outed you on this. Now, you look at the monopolies happening in health insurance in the United States and the monopolies in hospitalization, and then there's obviously the natural monopolies. I mean, how many companies can I buy electricity from? There's only one set of wires coming to my house. You look at these monopolies, and again, getting back to medicine, this story in today's Knight Ridder News Service, picking up on an article being published in today's Journal of the American Medical Association, Americans pay more than twice as much for their medical care as the British. We pay on a per-person basis $5,274 a year. That's every man, woman, and child with or without health insurance in the United States. That's the average of what we pay. The average person who's in, the average working person is spending over $11,000, but there's fewer working people than there are all people in the country, right? So, anyhow, the average person in the United States, $5,274 a year in the United States. In England, it's $2,164. Less than half of what the U.S. is paying. So you would expect that England would be a lot sicker, right? They pay, you know, they spend half as much on health care as we do. Well, we have a 12.5% rate of diabetes in the United States. What is it in England? It's 6.1%. It's less than half. And they're spending half as much money on health care. How can that be? They have, you know, 9.6% all types of heart disease. We have 15.1%. Hypertension, they're 33%. We're at 42%. Strokes, they're at 2.3%. We're at 3.8%. Heart attacks, they're at 4%, we're at 5.4%. Lung disease, they're at 6%, we're at 8%. Cancer, they're at 5%, we're at 9%. You get it that what's going on here is not that, you know, if you spend less money on health care, you get healthier. No, that's not the message. The message is that when you have monopolies controlling and a sector of the economy like we have in health insurance and like we have in the providing of health care, for that matter, and look at Bill Frist's daddy's company that has made Bill Frist's father and brother billionaires. These companies making these kinds of enormous, mind-boggling profits because they control such large chunks of the market are driving out competition, driving out competitors, and driving up costs. It's time for we the people to say enough on this already. Our phone number, 866-440-8466, tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Next, more on the economy serving our society and your calls. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 34 minutes after the hour, 25 minutes coming up on 25 minutes before the top of the hour. Is the economy here to serve society, or is society here to serve the economy? Indeed. The 10 Worst Corporations of 2005, Russell Mokaber and Robert Weissman put this thing together for the Multinational Monitor, their publication. You can find at multinationalmonitor.org, listed alphabetically the 10 Worst Corporations of last year and the lowlights of the activities that earned them a place in the list. BP. In March, 15 workers were incinerated, more than 170 injured following an explosion of BP's sprawling refinery in Texas City, Texas, the third fatal accident at the Texas City BP facility in the last 4 years. Nationwide, BP's facilities have had more than 3,565 accidents since 1990, ranking first in the nation, according to a 2004 report by the Texas Public Interest Research Group. Delphi, another company on their list, in October, according to Mokaber and Weissman, in October, Delphi CEO Steve Miller took his company into bankruptcy with the explicit purpose of trashing the social contract between unionized auto workers in the United States and the auto industry. He proposed slashing workers' wages from $27 an hour to a mere $10. And in a fit of staggering arrogance, Miller and Delphi simultaneously proposed huge bonuses for company executives. DuPont. Deadly chemicals from DuPont's perfluorinated chemical-based coatings and related surfaces sources are now in the blood of 95% of people in the United States. DuPont has claimed that it doesn't know how the chemicals got there, but Glenn Evers, formerly one of the company's top technical experts, says that DuPont for decades hid the fact that it was polluting people's blood with a hyper-persistent chemical associated with the grease-resistant coatings on paper food packaging. You can see all about this, by the way, at EWG.org. In December, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency agreed to settle claims against DuPont for a paltry $16.5 million. On a happier note, I guess, the agency and DuPont says they're going to phase out these chemicals by 2015. ExxonMobil on Mokuber and Weissman's list. In the face of a virtually complete scientific consensus that global warming is real and happening, and by the way, the White House just came out with a study today, a commission that George Bush put together in 2002 to try and debunk the IPCC's contention to over 2,200 of the world's leading climate scientists saying, yes, global climate change is real and humans have a role to play in it, or are playing a role in it. The Bushy Council came out with their report today. Yep, global warming's real and humans are playing a role in it. So now the White House is going, well, okay, we're going to have a couple more studies. Right. Well, back to ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil, this from Mokuber and Weissman. ExxonMobil continues to insist that, quote, scientific evidence remains inconclusive, end quote. So far, the cynical, profit-motivated, short-term, self-interested views of ExxonMobil have mattered more than the evidence-based perspective of the world's climatologists. That's because the most profitable corporation on Earth has lots of political power and is skilled at amplifying its views. See exposeExxon.org for details. And the climatologists do not and are not. While the world burns, ExxonMobil is raking in record profits, more than $36 billion in 2005, the highest ever earned for a single company in 1 year in the history of the world. And they go on and on and on through the list, and you know, we can come back and revisit it as time goes on. It's pretty amazing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. John in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better, John. What's up?
Well, last summer you were on the black box voting forums, and that was concerned with the issue of electronic voting. You remember that?
I am still concerned about the issue of electronic voting.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the key issue? I mean, if we can't even vote something into existence, or we can't even vote change into existence, then, you know, what's the point of talking politics?
Yeah, that's why I talk about that regularly on this program. In fact, just yesterday we were talking about how Jeff from Colorado called in and was sharing with us who the local officials are that you need to be contacting. And the fact of the matter is that most of your local county election officials or municipal election officials, you just look up, you know, your town in the local phone book and just call and ask and say, who's the person responsible for making the election work? And talking
right,
about
that's the county
like,
board supervisors.
Well, but, it'll vary from state to state, but by and large, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't want to go on to a voting issue. In terms of political science, Tom, right now there's a federal lawsuit currently before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And if guys like you and other people on Air America, Jim Hightower, if all the guys who are basically leading the charge against corporate rule in America today, if they started talking about this federal lawsuit, what would happen is America would convene its first Article 5 convention. And an Article 5 convention, which is popularly known as a constitutional convention, is exactly what the framers of the Constitution placed in that document for the situation we're experiencing today, where special interests are acting in their interest and against the public's interest. Now, on that forum, the black box voting forum, if I remember correctly, you said that a constitutional convention is dangerous. And
I continue to believe that. And I disagree with your contention that the reason that the founders put into the Constitution a means to amend it, and Jefferson, in fact, suggested that every 19 years, every generation, the Constitution should be revisited. I disagree with your contention that they did that because they expected that in a time when special interests are reigning, that's when the Constitution should be amended. In fact, I'd say, if anything, that would have been the thing that they would have been most horrified of. This is the reason why I don't think we should have a constitutional convention, is because the constitutional convention is going to be convened by politicians who are in the pocket of big corporations. Do you really think they're going to rewrite the Constitution, make it more democratic?
Hang on right there. This is the rhetoric against a convention that is totally invalid. Let me tell you why. The only thing that can come out of a convention is a roster of ideas. That's it. A convention does not have ratification powers. It can't rewrite anything. Whoever gets into the convention, whoever is sent to the convention, they can't do anything to the Constitution. All they can do is stand up and propose ideas.
Right, and then it goes before the House and Senate, and has to have...
No. Then it goes out to the 50 states for ratification, and you need 75% of states to agree to something before...
75% of the legislators in the states. And I don't know about your state, John, California. Actually, I do. I can tell you, here in Oregon, a good solid half of the House of Representatives, in fact, more than half of the House of Representatives in this state, is clearly and strongly in the pockets of big corporations.
Okay, listen,
and I wouldn't trust the Republicans who run the House of Representatives in this state to be voting on any constitutional convention.
Let's look at things in terms of theory and in practice. The one thing that's going on right now in America is the corporate media is not covering any of the issues that we really need covered. For instance, the electronic voting issue. So let's just say, for argument, let's say we had a convention. Let's say we had our first Article 5 convention, and all of a sudden the states were running elections for delegates, and those delegates flew to Washington, D.C., and the gavel falls on that convention, and the delegates start proposing ideas. Now, number one, it would be such a monumental event in American political discourse that everyone who has turned off politics because it's such a charade would suddenly be tuning back in.
You're dreaming,
and
John.
The delegates, all the delegates.
I'm sorry, John, you're dreaming. You're dreaming. This is a real issue. This is a real issue that needs to be dealt with right now. We are not going to have a constitutional convention. It ain't going to happen. And if it did happen, as I said, it's going to be politicians. It's going to be John. Thanks a lot for that. I'm going to move along. I'm sorry. It's just that this is we're going around in circles here. Brant and is it Brant in Berkeley, California?
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, Brant, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I got a theory about immigration and some of the problems that are surrounding itself around this issue. I personally believe, I've sort of really, really been looking at this, and I believe that this, to me, seemingly could be considered a trick by the Republican Party in order to ignite a problem, an issue, to then raise funds for the year.
I think they were hoping that it could be, but it's blowing up in their faces.
Yeah, because I think they're in so much, they're so fractured as a party right now. I don't believe they want to make people illegal, make immigrants legal in this country. They would prefer them to be off balance, illegal, so we don't have to pay them for every American does have cut workers' comp and whatnot. You have. So I'm sort of ruling that this thing is a trick just to raise money. People who are upset about the illegal immigration want to build walls. That's not going to happen. Nobody's going to build a wall. Even the right wingers and the right wingers who want to build a wall seemingly don't understand that they're not going to be doing anything of that nature. They're actually going to make they're not going to make any promises. We're going to say we're going to take your money, not guarantee.
It'll be a great contract for Halliburton.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that's the humor of this thing, because I can't seem to accept what these people are saying these days and some of the theories they're throwing around of what, well, we'll build a wall, well, we can't promise you to do this.
It's very simple. If you want to stop illegal immigration in the United States, you stop employers from hiring illegal immigrants. The day that the jobs stop, people will stop coming. There are a number of issues that are feeding into this. Obviously, our trade policies are a piece of it. Our support of agricultural, particularly corn, subsidies to the corn industry are a part of it. We're doing a whole lot of horrible things down in Mexico, and we're supporting a corrupt regime down there. But the day that we stop the jobs, people will stop coming here, and they'll start standing up to their own government, which would be a good thing. Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot, Brant. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Is the economy here to serve us, or are we here to serve the economy? We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour. 866-440-8466, our telephone number.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land.
Well, it depends on whether or not you could get a construction job, you know. It's getting tougher and tougher. Welcome back, my friends. And for our listeners in Fiji and New Zealand, and I know we do have quite a few, actually hundreds if not thousands of international listeners to the web streams, the various web streams for this program. If you're in Fiji or New Zealand and you're near the water, there's a tsunami warning just issued. There was an 8.0 magnitude quake 90 miles off the coast of Tonga, and it may be heading your way. So heads up. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bruno in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bruno, what's on your mind?
Bruno, good morning, Tom.
Hey.
And, Tom, as I was listening to the gentleman, Wayne Cruz, the two of you were talking, and all I wanted to mention was, in listening to people such as Wayne Cruz, whom I consider supporting an extreme rightist view,
or at least laissez-faire capitalism. I mean, absolutely unregulated capitalism is what he's supporting.
And to me, their arguments become what I call circular. That regardless of how someone such as yourself would respond to them, it's they take a position of, well, of course we agree with what you're saying, but, and so they soften, they're seemingly trying to soften their position by saying, of course, I agree with you. And then there's that inevitable but.
Yeah.
And it always comes back to agenda. And in listening to them, it's after it's all over, it's always the sense of like, well, gosh, wasn't that wonderful? And no, he didn't say anything. There wasn't anything substantial.
You know. Well, I think, you know, what he did say was the position that is taken by advocates of laissez-faire capitalism, which is if you simply leave corporations alone, ultimately that will be the best thing for society. And history does not demonstrate that that's the case.
No, exactly. And the thing is that there has been, continues to be, and at this point in our history, there's such an extreme need for government to step in and to regulate industry, period. It's just, it has run amok. And with the insanity of the government that we have, it is beyond simply out of control.
I'm right there with you, Bruno.
And again, I just simply feel that in listening with people like that, I am so grateful that you're on the air and that you not simply, not only do you counter their arguments, but you show their arguments for what they are, empty, hollow, and just not having place. But for a lot of people, it almost seems as though they're saying something.
Yeah. It is a religion.
As we progress, certainly in the near term, that more people are able to become active and become aware of what it is that's really going on. And one of the outlets that allows that to happen is a program such as the one you have. So, yeah. Tom, thank you so much for just having me on the air and listening.
Well, thanks a lot for calling, Bruno, and thanks for listening to us there on Sirius Satellite Radio. I appreciate it. Henry in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Henry, what's up?
Oh, not a lot. Just trying to make a dollar today.
Yeah, it's getting tougher and tougher these days.
Although
the Bushies will tell you the economy is rip-roaring good.
Yeah, well, the thing I want to talk about, just to answer your first question first, do corporations belong to, well, anyway, I think each one of them need to coexist together because without one, the other won't even exist.
Society and the economy, I agree. But that means that we're going to have democracy. That means that we, the people, are going to have some say in how the marketplace operates. And that's intolerable to these guys.
That's what should happen. And that's one other thing that I was calling about. Okay, oil companies, they started back in the late 80s when they started, these refineries, they shut down. Mm-hmm. All it is, when they did, they merged, they shut them down. And they used the biggest excuse of us, everybody's bleed. Rather, the EPA is the reason why we can't get these refineries online. And that's an excuse there, a reason why they won't build a new refinery.
Yeah.
My thing is, as a society, at what point are we going to tell corporate America, look here, you can't do this. You can't hold us hostage for everything that you want to do.
Right. I agree with you, Henry. And my suggestion, my cure for this problem is break up the big oil companies. We have basically four companies running all the oil business in the United States. 20 years ago, there were over 20 companies, and there was a lot of competition. And that competition is just gone now, and you're seeing the inevitable consequence of it.
So let's look at Pennsylvania right now. Pennsylvania started out with all these companies came in there and want to take over the electrical power part of the state.
Yeah.
Okay, they came in, and then the larger companies bought out the smaller companies, and now they had a one-time 75% increase in their bill.
Yeah.
Is that fair to the people who can't even afford the power they pay for it now?
Yeah, no, it's, welcome back to Enron. I mean, that's what we're seeing is Enron economics all over again. Henry, thanks a lot for the call. Got to move along. Nate in St. Cloud. Hey, Nate, we got 1 minute left here to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Hey, I was wondering what you say to the all the right wing hosts who say that it's the liberals' fault and for the gas prices going up
because Bill Clinton didn't let them drill in Anwar
and everything else and
yeah.
The standards and
I would say that one of the reasons why gas prices are so high right now, other than the fact that you've got only four major oil companies and they're apparently colluding to diminish production, capacity, refinery capacity. They've closed 55 refineries in the last 10 years, according to Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio, number one. But number two, you have Republicans who for the past 15, 20 years have fought every effort to raise the average fuel efficiency standards among the automakers, the fleet efficiency, CAFE, the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel efficiency standards. And as a consequence, cars today are getting worse gas mileage than they were 25 years ago. And cars are where most of that, virtually all of that gasoline is going. Most of our oil is going. As a result, gee, the price is going up. What a surprise. And the air is getting dirtier. And there's more mercury in the air. It's on and on it goes. It's crazy. No, I'd say it's all the conservatives' fault. If you want to be blame lane, it seems like a pretty good one. After the break, the latest in progressive framing with Jeffrey Feldman. Frameshopisopen.com. How are the cons framing the future? And what should we be doing? What can Democrats and progressives be doing to define a positive future? We'll be talking to Jeffrey Feldman about that right after the break. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour, 1 week from tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Make an appointment with your TiVo or VCR or whatever. The Discovery Channel is going to have a special on called... Let me get to the page here. JFK, this conspiracy files, the JFK assassination. And as far as I can tell, I may be wrong, but I don't think so. It's going to feature Lamar Waldron and I. We wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice about that topic and spent the better part of a couple of days in New York City with an NBC camera crew following us around. And as far as I know, it's going to be on the Discovery Channel 1 week from tonight. So just a heads up. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. He's the editor-in-chief at Frameshop is Open. Frameshopisopen.com. Be sure you get the is open part in there. And Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Frameshop. April was the cruelest month?
Yes. This is my alluding back to my English major as an undergraduate. Of course, is reference to T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland.
Yes.
A great American poem written in the early part of the 20th century.
And we are the hollow men. heads.
Exactly. What I was trying to reference is this amazing attempt by the White House this past week to turn what has been really an incredible downward trend in their fortunes into something that looks to be success, using a couple of key phrases that they turn to over and over again. Those two phrases are moving forward, which showed up in Scott McClellan's press briefing in the past few days, half a dozen times in one briefing, used to describe just about every single policy that the president is putting out there. And then another phrase called the turning point. Turning point has been used by Condoleezza Rice and everybody else in the administration to describe what's going on in Iraq. Condi Rice and Donald Rumsfeld went and took a visit to talk to, theoretically, to talk to the government over there, and they came back talking all about how finally Iraq is reaching a turning point in a way to try to convince the American public that things are going well. And what I talk about is how these two concepts, the attempt by the Bush administration to distract the public from what's actually happening in the here and now, to distract them from all the problems that they've created, that the American public, that we as a nation now have to face in the present. The administration wants to distract us from that towards this imagined future, down the road, up the line, where everything is going well, and just up ahead is the turn we've all been waiting for and everything's going to be okay. It's a rhetorical device using a basic metaphor that we call a path metaphor, thinking about things in terms of a regular set progress, one step after the other, when in fact the problem that the administration is having is the inability to achieve any of its goals.
You used a great metaphor, driving with Dad.
Yes. we've all had this experience when you're growing up. You know, you get in the car and you're heading off to a new place with your father at the wheel. And at a certain point in time, we realize that we're lost. And so you turn to your father or your husband and you say, look, I think we should stop and ask for directions, at which point Dad at the wheel says, nope, there's our turn right up ahead there. And I use that metaphor, and I believe I am not above having pulled this trick on once or twice in my own life.
This is called driving while male. Right?
Driving while male, exactly. It's an American male affliction. We all do this. And this is precisely the type of behavior that we're seeing from our president. The one thing that he should be doing is he should be asking for help. He needs to stop and ask for help. And there are all kinds of people who are offering their help.
Ask for directions.
Ask for directions,
essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as you said, there is all kinds of people offering it, but I don't think he's going to do it.
He's definitely not going to do it, because to admit that he needs help to find the right road is to admit complete failure. And this is the real problem. It's a dangerous problem that the president has put the entire country in, that he's staked his success, his legacy on this Iraq policy, and in this his unwillingness to tarnish what he sees as a legacy, which is already completely tarnished.
How did the Democrats respond to this, or do they follow Napoleon's advice, you know, when your enemy is destroying himself, get out of his way, and just allow Bush to go down in flames? That seems to be what the Democrats are doing, but I don't think it's an intentional strategy. I think it's because there's so much internal dissent about what should be done that that's the default.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's basically what I see are two responses to this type of turning point rhetoric coming out of the Bush administration. The first one we're familiar with, coming from people like Russ Feingold, who are calling for a complete reworking of the Iraq policy right now, to focus on not just one place in Iraq, but to a more broad strategy to hunt down al-Qaeda. Feingold is being very, very vocal, building on, you know, people like Mirza, to a limited extent people like Nancy Pelosi. On the other hand, you've got, I think, leading growing voices in the party, people like Mark Warner, who are saying, look, whatever happens, we're going to inherit this policy, and when the time comes, we're going to have to fix it at that moment. We don't have national security briefings right now, so let's not stake ourselves to a policy that's just going to be ripped to shreds by the GOP smear machine. Let's focus instead on optimism, on talking about competence and management in the future. So there's a real divide there. I think that Democrats can find a unified voice if they simply talk about the importance of action. What's important is that the president, our government, band together and we do something to make things better in Iraq. We talk about action, and the opposite of that, the criticism, is that the president is suffering from inaction.
Interesting. And the action, for example, Jack Murtha suggested,
exactly.
Redeployed to the perimeter.
redeployment. I mean, there's many different ways, and I think it's healthy to have a variety of expert Democrats, or Democrats who know foreign policy, they know the military very well, to have this very public national discussion, people like Wes Clark and Jack Murtha.
Yeah. Three steps to better protests and need a girlfriend congressman. We have about 3 minutes left, and I want to be sure and cover both of these. So let me just toss them both to you here. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, and you're the expert frame person here. What are these two frames, and how should they be used?
Well, the first one is about Duke Cunningham, who was caught up. He's a disgraced representative from San Diego, and he was caught up in a scandal involving taking bribes and gifts from lobbyists, in particular military defense contractors. And it just came to light that above and beyond money and expensive gifts, they were also arranging limousine rides to hotel suites where there were prepaid prostitutes waiting for him and God knows how many other members of our Republican government. So just talking about linking that, talking about prostitution, there's all different kinds of ways that you can spin together a bunch of puns. That's a good way to talk about the problems that the Republican Party is having. The other one is there was a huge protest in New York City this past weekend that I participated in. An anti-war slash peace protest. And while it was very important, I felt that it could be much more effective. And so I put forward three proposals whereby progressives could be more effective in these large weekend type of protests. And that is simply pick a unified color so that everybody looks the same, a unified slogan so that everybody is saying the same thing. And I suggested a very simple, basic gesture, reminiscent of the type of gesture that was used in anti-apartheid protests, raising a hand over the head so that everybody could feel they were participating in a common action.
Yeah, this is something that the illegal immigrants seem to have seized on. I mean, they're using your strategy, apparently being driven by Spanish language DJs.
Immigrant protests have been absolutely fantastic, but they also draw on Spanish language union approaches to protests, which have been very effective. During the immigrant marches, you hear such phrases as si se puede, which is something that resonates across a broad spectrum of people in the Spanish-speaking community in this country, and they've been much more effective, I think, than these broad anti-war protests. Both are important. But
so the anti-war movement needs to learn something from the illegal immigrant movement.
Apparently. Exactly. They need to learn to be more focused. And there's a lot of people with a lot of passion there, but it doesn't take much effort to follow these three suggestions that I recommend.
Yeah. And finally, the oil addiction conniption.
I mean, the president continues to talk about oil addiction as a problem in this country. The Democrats, I'm arguing, need to really lead this debate that's flaring up around high gas prices. We saw this past week the Republicans put forward a ridiculous proposal to send every American a check for $100 as a way of buying off their anxiety.
Rick Santorum is still flogging this thing. It's incredible. You want to say, Rick, it's dead.
It's completely dead, but the Democrats need to stand up and they need to really show strong leadership. I mean, they need to go back, and I think they need to remember the type of passion that someone like Jimmy Carter brought to the table in talking about conservation initially, and a complete rethinking of how we relate to oil and its use. We can't just talk about prices. We need to talk about, you know, taxing SUVs and dealing with oil exec salaries and a whole...
CAFE standards.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just this whole thing, and the extent to which the cons are out there now, this is the new talking point. I'm getting these things in these emails that I get from these right-wing think tanks for right-wing talk show hosts. The new talking point is gas prices are high because Bill Clinton wouldn't allow drilling in Anwar. And I guarantee you, they're all going to be saying that. If they're not doing it right now, they will within a day or so, because it's, you know, yesterday and today, I've probably gotten five emails from various think tanks and you know, the GOP basically saying this. And the Democrats need to be saying, no, oil, gas prices are high because for 25 years, the Republicans have stalled any efforts to raise CAFE standards.
Exactly.
Or, for that matter, it wouldn't matter how high they are. If your car got 45, 50, 55, 60 miles per gallon, GM is making 60-mile-per-gallon cars in Europe that are gasoline only. They're making flex-fuel cars down in Brazil. What's wrong with us here?
We should have it over here.
Indeed. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Come together right now over me.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, what are they spinning out there today?
Oh, my goodness, Tom. I just got out of the briefing by Assistant Homeland Security Secretary Fran Townsend as they laid on us the flu pandemic. Hang on, I'll give you the title. National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza Implementation Plan Briefing Book is what I have in front of me.
It's
the flu book.
Yeah.
Now,
my understanding is that essentially you could boil the Bush administration's policy or plan for the bird flu down to a couple of words. Do what we did with Katrina.
Well, that's actually true, but it would be because you're a very astute person. A couple of things. One is that when he was pushed, or she was pushed in terms of who actually is in charge, it turns out that, this is going to shock you, Michael Chertoff actually would be the incident manager if there were a pandemic. So
just like with Katrina.
Exactly. So that's a comfort to us all because he did such a good job in that case. And some of the things that we should bear in mind, we shouldn't sit any closer together than 3 feet apart.
No, this is very wise advice to avoid getting the flu.
Well, avoid getting anything else either.
Right. Now, how am I going to fly in an airplane?
Well, you probably won't be flying because non-essential domestic travel is going to be strongly discouraged. Now, I asked a question about that. I was told that, you know, that they would be urging people not to make non-essential journeys. They're not going to stop it, as far as we can see, when I asked how it was going to be enforced. They're just going to be urging people not to do it. In other words, not to go on vacation.
Well, you know, that is kind of a legitimate balancing act, because on the one hand, you want the government to do everything they can to prevent a pandemic and the deaths of millions of people. On the other hand, you don't want to hand over to particularly this crowd absolute dictatorial power to control and regulate people's travel and movement.
Well, and that's a concern because, as it is, you know, even the Republicans are concerned with this crowd, as you call them, dictatorial policies. We had the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, yesterday coming under a lot of questioning, a lot of questioning from the Senate Judiciary Committee, in which he was being lambasted for the FBI going after various peace organizations such as the Raging Grannies and the Quakers, Catholic anti-war organizations, and various others who have never harmed anybody in their lives, but who the FBI apparently have decided are threats terrorist-wise.
Right. Well, not just the FBI now. The Bush administration has given grants to, my recollection is, well over 900 local community police departments, and those police departments are setting up, I mean, we're back, they're reincarnating the Red Squads of the 60s and 70s that local police departments had, where they were looking into and following around anti-war activists, and in some cases, you know, setting them up with phony arrests and things like this in order to take them out. It's back.
But we'll be told, don't worry, if you didn't do anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. So there you are, Tom. If you didn't do anything wrong, you won't have anything to worry about. And, of course, we know that you did somewhere, sometime, somehow, so you probably do have something to worry about.
And if you haven't done anything wrong, we'll just pass a law to make sure you do.
Exactly. And that's not too difficult, and they're passing laws all the time, as you know. Speaking of laws, a bit of a leap here, but the grand jury in the Valerie Plame case is supposed to have met today. We don't yet know whether it did. But there was a large rumor going around Washington, D.C. that it was meeting. Why it was meeting, we don't know. Was it to hear more evidence? Was it to continue to go through Karl Rove's testimony from last week and to compare with his testimony from his previous appearances? Or was it to start putting together a case against him? We don't know. But none of this is good news for Karl Rove.
Well, I'm hearing rumors that he might be indicted this Friday. Have you heard that?
I haven't heard a particular day.
Yeah, that... Interesting. Well, we'll see how this shakes out. So, let's see, bird flu. Oh, oil. What's being done with gas and oil? That's a fairly hysterical issue.
Well, gas and oil, yes. The Republicans have withdrawn the $100 checks that they were going to mail us. I was looking forward to that because there were a couple of items on eBay that I was looking on.
Isn't Ricky Santorum out there still saying, no, we want to give him $100?
He's almost the only one. Even Senator John Cornyn and, Representative John Boehner, they're all saying, this is a dreadful idea. I'm running from it as fast as I can. Because not one every constituent, as I think I've said to you before, is saying, now listen, you're trying to buy me like a prostitute. And if you're going to try and bleep me, at least lick my ear and buy me a Grand Slam breakfast at Denny's first.
Right. Yeah. And here's where it gets really weird. I mean, because the logic of what they're saying is, we're going to take your tax dollars. And it's going to be more than 100 of your tax dollars because there's an administrative cost. You know, there's an overhead here. We're going to take your, we're going to take 120 of your tax dollars to give you $100 that you can then hand over to ExxonMobil so that Lee Raymond can retire with another $400 million.
Because they need it.
That's right. That's right. And it's, I think a lot of Americans are going, hey, wait a minute. I, you know, this is not a good use of government money, of my tax dollars.
Yeah, my taxpayer money. I
yeah.
Find
or of money that you're borrowing in my children and grandchildren's name from China, for that matter. Speaking of which, any movement on securing our ports?
I've heard nothing at all this week. Nothing that I could give you an update on. No.
Interesting. I was talking with Peter DeFazio this morning about that, and he's really, really getting on the case of these guys. He says, you know, apparently the Bush administration has said that they want to start investigating containers after they leave the ports, after they've already arrived.
That sounds a bit sort of backwards.
Yeah, yeah, but that's apparently that testimony was given before him yesterday in Congress.
Well, now look, Tom, be charitable. It's a start.
Yeah, we're going to check for the bomb after. Oh, man. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, The True People's Radio.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. There you go. Stand in the place where you live. Well, there's a lot of folks who aren't. They're going someplace other than where they live. And the Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, I don't know how you say it. Arpaio. Arpaio? Yeah. Anyhow, the sheriff of Maricopa County, that's the county in Arizona that includes Phoenix, or a good chunk of Phoenix, has put together a 3,000-member volunteer posse to go out looking for illegal aliens, and he's finding them. He says, there are so many illegals trying to make it into the country that it's overwhelming my deputies, so I've called on members of my 3,000-member volunteer posse to assist. He said, it's not only illegals we find in arrest out there, we've also made some recent huge drug seizures involving illegal aliens, including nearly 100 pounds of methamphetamine and approximately 3 pounds of heroin. This is from KPHO in Phoenix, a TV station, I believe, might be a radio station in Phoenix. Posse man Andrew Ramsamy, who was part of Tuesday's arrest team, they just went out with 100 posses and busted 11 illegal immigrants. This guy, who was a member of the team, said he believes he represents many of his peers when he says that the posse is anxious to be part of the sheriff's solution to the immigration problem. Again, I'm quoting here from this KPHO's story. He said, as a group of law-abiding people, we're fed up with the number of people who come into this country illegally. We're tired of the drugs that some of them bring to sell to our young people, and we're ready and willing to assist the sheriff's deputies in fighting against illegal immigration. Now, here's where it gets really grim. This is the human toll of this. Sheriff Arpaio said Tuesday's arrests included two coyotes, one of whom may be charged with a far more serious offense, endangerment. Virgilio Parra Sabori may face a Class 6 felony charge if it's determined that he recklessly left one of his customers to die in the desert. That customer, who may have paid as much as $1,100 to gain entrance into the country, was a 24-year-old Mexican male found near death by deputies who combed the desert earlier today after being told by other people in the vehicle that one man was left behind. That young man was found lying in the sun on the desert floor and is currently in serious condition in a West Valley hospital. Arpaio says his deputies so far have made 7 anti-smuggling cases in just the last few weeks alone, and that 120 illegals have been arrested and jailed. This is Maricopa County. This is all the way up near Phoenix. He houses 10,000 prisoners in his jails, including 2,000 in a tent city. Arpaio is how it's pronounced. Arpaio. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Thank you. Now, there are some folks who are going to say, you know, this is a terrible thing. Look at this, people dying. And therefore, we should, you know, present our rage against who? I would say against the companies that are offering employment and the people who are offering employment to these people, which is drawing them into this country. If there wasn't a job here waiting for them, they wouldn't be coming. We have evidence now that there are companies in the United States that are actually going down to Mexico and negotiating with coyotes to recruit people and bring them across the border. They're paying up front and bringing folks across the border and saying, if you can get them to Nebraska, if you can get them to Kansas, if you can get them to Chicago, if you can get them into Michigan, get them up to Pennsylvania, whatever. Let's dry up the demand. And then, hopefully people will have an incentive in Mexico to change Mexican policy and to say from Mexico no to U.S. policies like NAFTA. But as long as the second largest source of revenue for the government of Mexico, this, you know, something that is keeping the Mexican economy afloat, is repatriated, is, you know, funds, checks sent back to Mexico by people working here illegally. As long as that's the second largest source of revenue for that government or for that nation, for the people of Mexico, they're not going to try and change anything. The system is working out, you know, fairly well, other than for people who die in the desert. It's a terrible thing. And we all bear some responsibility for this. We're allowing this disaster to happen. I think it's just a tragedy. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. George in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
George. Hello. I was calling about the illegal criminal espionage program that Bush has been engaging in against innocent American citizens.
Since before 9/11, by the way, we now learn.
Yes. I don't hear much on the radio about the fact that all of the Americans he's illegally wiretapping are innocent, but none of them are terrorists.
Right, because if they were,
Bush stated previously that a wiretap requires a warrant, and when it comes to chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a warrant.
Right.
And he's confessed he's been engaging in this kind of espionage against Americans without a warrant. So if they were terrorists, he would have got a warrant. And the fact he hasn't got a warrant means he knows they're not terrorists. He knows they're innocent.
So the question, I agree with you, George. So the question here is, you know, what are we going to do about this? This has been talked about. It's amazing. I mean, about half of Americans, you look at the polls, about half of Americans believe that Bush is doing something positive, that his terrorist investigation program or whatever he's calling it, terrorist surveillance program. And that the Republicans have been spinning this thing. I mean, they're buying this. The media is shoveling it to them, and they're saying, oh, hey, that stuff smells pretty good. What are we going to do?
Well, personally, I would boycott all Republican candidates, but...
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a good start. George, thanks for the call. Yes, we have to point this out to people. I mean, this is you're absolutely right, and it's absolutely over the top what George W. Bush is doing. And it goes beyond this. As Charlie Savage pointed out in the Boston Globe on Monday of this week, over 750 laws now, George W. Bush has said, I don't need to follow those laws. 750 laws. He has actively broken. Now, the average person, if they actively break even two or three laws, they're confronting some serious problems. Bush, well, he's got his enablers. You know, when our Busto oil was going down the tubes, he had Salman bin Laden. He had Osama bin Laden's brother to bail him out and, you know, give him some money to keep his company afloat. When Harkin Energy was going down, he had his daddy, make sure that the SEC did not investigate the fact that he was involved in insider trading and sold his stock out before, you know, just weeks before the stock tanked. When the opportunity to buy into the stadium, the baseball team down there in Texas came along, you know, his daddy's friends took care of him. He's always had enablers. He's at Yale. He's, you know, strutting around, and he's got people taking his tests for him and people showing up for class for him. I mean, Kitty Kelly documents all of this in her book, The Family. It's really amazing how George W. Bush has had people basically always bail him out, and now the Republican Party is doing it again. Enablers. And sometimes you have to say to enablers, sorry, we're not going to let you enable anymore. Stephen in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I used to work at a Goodyear factory here in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, at any given time, about 50% of their workforce were illegal Mexicans, mostly from Veracruz. And I was actually...
Why that particular town?
I don't know. It was like a bunch of people in that town said, hey, yeah, it's great near Atlanta. Let's all go near Atlanta and we can be together or something. I'm not sure. But anyway, they all came through Arizona. I got to be good friends with them and everything. They're great people. But I agree with you. We're just supporting slavery light. And these CEOs, one of the big wigs, I don't know if he was the top guy in Goodyear, he was actually the number two guy. He came walking through the plant one day. And, I mean, they know what's going on. They know what's happening. They should be blamed for this.
Yeah, and it's not just Goodyear.
I know, it's not just them. That's just one example. Everybody, you know, wants to think, oh, it's just they're working in the fields and this and that. No, I turned down, you know, for every illegal. They would get on me if I didn't hire enough illegal labor. They would yell at me.
You were a manager of some sort?
I was a recruiter. I actually worked for a temp service, so mm-hmm. that would insulate them, you know, insulate Goodyear. I worked for manpower.
So they're hiring from a company that's hiring. This is sort of like the U.S. embassy that's being built in Iraq right now. One Iraqi is actually working on that construction project. 21 buildings. It's filling the skyline. It's absolutely huge. It's the only construction project in the city that's on schedule and on budget. And not one Iraqi working on it because they've farmed all this out to Kuwaiti subcontractors, and they're bringing in workers from Pakistan and Sri Lanka and like that.
Yeah, all illegal labor, and it's all set up and with a wink and a nod, and it actually turned to the point where I had to inform the illegals on how to buy a proper fake green card and a fake Social Security card and what numbers needed to match with the dates on the front of the card and the back, and so that we could insulate ourselves. So they know it's all going on. The employers aren't just victims in this. They're actually the perpetrators.
Yeah.
In a very real way, I was, you know, actually instructed on how to help them illegally gain employment through us. And what the temp service did was just insulate Goodyear, but Goodyear knew exactly what was going on, and they would actually kind of control me in a way and say, we need more illegal labor. You need to turn away more American citizens. And I'd get 5 to 10 people come in for every illegal person I'd hire. And I'd turn away those 5 or 10 American citizens who were looking for work.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the new American economy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Stephen
in Atlanta, thanks for the call and the heads up. Whew. Yeah, and a story that's being replicated all over America. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The moon is pulling at me, the moon is pulling at you. You swear to me it's the sun that's shining through. It's hard to push for the truth when lies are easy to find. I'm left with this trouble in mind.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. We started the program an hour and 50 minutes ago here with the issue of the accumulation of corporate power and its impact on America. There's a very human dimension to this, to bring this all the way back around. And you know, we can continue talking about this as we go into the next hour of the program as well. But this, I just want to close this thing up. On this in particular, today the Knight Ridder News Service is reporting that nearly 2.8 million teenagers in the United States, that's a lot of kids, 2.8 million teenagers in the United States are at risk for developing a disease that 20 years ago you never saw in anybody, virtually never saw in anybody who was under 40. It was a disease of old age and obesity. It was something you just never saw in kids. And now we have 2.8 million teenagers at risk for type 2 diabetes. This at the same time that the Journal of the American Medical Association today publishing a report showing that England, they just looked at basically white males, non-Hispanic whites, ages 55 to 64 years old, basically white old guys in the UK versus the US. And in the UK, they had half the diabetes rate that they do in the United States. Actually, less than half the diabetes rate. 6.1% in the UK versus 12.5% in the U.S. And then when you look at our teenagers, you see that diabetes is exploding here. The last time I was in the United Kingdom was about a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago. And I remember we were out driving on the motorway and stopped to get something to drink, and they've got all these little containers, cartons of fruit juice, different kinds of fruit juice, you know, Loganberry juice and you know whatnot. I remember a purple one that was really good. And you look on the ingredients, and it's like juicy juice kind of stuff. You know, it's flavored with fruit juice. But at the same time, last weekend, I was down in Tampa, and a fellow hosting my visit down there to the library in Largo, Eric Girard, he took me out to breakfast, and the restaurant we went to, I said, I'd like a glass of grapefruit juice. And they brought me pop. They brought me this stuff. I took one drink of this, and I said, this is not just sugar. This is corn syrup. And she's like, no, that's grapefruit juice. It's like Ocean Spray or something. You know, this is, I said, look at the bottle. She comes back, and she says, you're right. The first ingredient was water. The second ingredient was corn syrup. And, you know, what's happening is that in my opinion, I may be wrong on this, but in my opinion, corn syrup is one of the major problems that we have. Not the old-fashioned Karo syrup corn syrup, but this new chemical that came into the American food supply in the 1970s called high-fructose corn syrup, that Coke changed their formula to shift away from cane sugar into this high-fructose corn syrup. And there's increasing evidence that this stuff is metabolized in the body in a very different fashion than the sugars that normally humans have eaten over the last 170,000 years. This is a new food or a new chemical that's been in our bloodstreams just for about 20 or 30 years. And just during that time, and just largely in the United States, because the corn manufacturers, the corn growers, are getting these huge taxpayer, you know, subsidies so that they could drive down the cost of the sweeteners. And who's driving that? Well, it's the candy companies. And the soft drink companies, they're buying legislative muscle in Washington, D.C. to give giant tax breaks and, in fact, even grants in some cases to these corn growers, the corn manufacturers, the high fructose corn syrup manufacturers. The byproduct of this, by the way, being that there's a surplus of corn on the market that ends up down and south of the border, which is driving small subsistence farmers, people who are growing, you know, enough corn on their 5 acres to eat themselves and to sell to 4 or 5 local families, driving them out of business. Because people can buy American corn cheaper than they can buy it from the guy who grows it next door. So we're exporting poverty. We're destroying the agricultural infrastructure of Central and South American countries. And, you know, 1.3 million new cases of type 2 diabetes in the United States being diagnosed every year. 2.8 million teenagers on the brink of developing this disease. 39,000 already have it. A disease that we never saw before in people under 40 years old. In type 2 diabetes, your pancreas is working just fine. It's producing all the insulin you need. It's just that your body's not reacting to that insulin. Why? I think, again, I may be wrong, but I think it has to do with corn syrup. You look at the rise in corn syrup in this country, consumption of it, and it's in everything. It's in our bread. It's in everything. And you look at the rise of these problems, and they seem to parallel. And I know when I quit eating corn syrup a couple of years ago, I noticed a difference in my health, and I also noticed that I lost some weight. And I've had a lot of people call into this program over the years since I first pointed that out and say, you know, I went on a diet, just quit eating corn syrup. That's all I did. Took the corn syrup out of my diet, and I'm losing weight. It's amazing. I think I should write a book, right? The non-corn syrup diet. We could create a whole new thing here, and you know, a whole new book industry, right? Come up with a book. All you have to do is just take. You can eat the same amount of food, the same stuff. If even sweet things, even candy bars and things. You can go to the health food store. You can get things that are made with cane sugar. You know, the old-fashioned sugar, real sugar. But corn syrup, dangerous stuff. And again, it gets back to, we've got a small handful of corporations controlling agriculture in the United States. Coming up in the next hour, a toilet, a butt, and Walmart. I'll tell you what they all have in common after the break, after the news at the top of the hour. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting, for a change. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest, the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me. Welcome back to our program. Time now for, as promised, a Walmart alert.
I hate Walmart.
Well, at least one guy in Salisbury, Maryland does.
Historic. Well, here's how it is. Big company sell for low cost. Drive mom and pop out of business. Purchasing all over the land. One big square store. I think a brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
And so does this poor guy, 20 years old, found by a Walmart employee in the bathroom in Salisbury, Maryland, Sunday night after he sat down and was glued to the toilet seat. The man, whose name is not released by police, was taken to the hospital late Sunday night, said Lieutenant Cheryl Rance of the Salisbury Police Department. She said he'd gone into the bathroom and sat down. He was banging on the wall when the employee came in. The man was treated and released. What I'm curious about was this a prankster who just happened to put super glue on the seat of a toilet in a Walmart? Or was this part of an anti-Walmart protest that's going on in Salisbury, Maryland that's not being reported? I don't know. If it's part of a protest, it's clearly inappropriate. Shouldn't have this sort of thing going on. 1-866-440-8466. We were talking about, just before the news, we were talking about high fructose corn syrup in everything. And a number of people calling with thoughts on the topic. Craig in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Good day, Tom.
Hey, Craig.
I'm glad to hear from you. The reason I'm calling is because I think high fructose corn syrup is the crack of the food industry.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that you mentioned crack, because the tobacco industry has done the same thing. This just came out, you know, like 15 years ago. We just discovered that back in the 1950s, the tobacco industry discovered that if they added ammonia to tobacco, it would change the pH of the tobacco. In other words, it would make it more alkaline, making the nicotine more alkaline. And things that are alkaline stick to our blood really quickly because our blood's very acidic. And
is that what it is?
That's right. Yeah, and that's called freebasing. And the reason it's called base is because when things are more alkaline, they're more base, right? It's base and acid. And so you do
the
same thing.
Well, I think that's the process they use to sort of turn the cocaine into the smokable product.
That's exactly right.
And I heard that they use the ammonia in the tobacco to do the same thing.
That's exactly right. You can convert cocaine into crack cocaine by making it alkaline, by alkalizing it, and you can convert nicotine into crack nicotine by alkalizing it, and that's what they do with tobacco, with cigarettes in the United States, and have been doing since the 1940s, 1950s. I'd say you're absolutely right when you say that corn syrup is the version of the same thing. I don't know. Yeah, I don't think that it has to do with being alkaline.
The thing is that I've noticed is when you eat stuff that's filled with high fructose corn syrup, you should have had enough that your body should be telling you that you're stuffed, and you're still going, I want more.
Yeah. Yeah, and thus we have these giant Slurpees or whatever they're called, you know, these giant drinks that are now 30 ounces, 40 ounces, 45 ounces, you know, people drinking a liter, 2 liters of this stuff a day when back in the day when it was cane sugar, you know, you'd drink a bottle of pop and you go, whoa, good sugar buzz there, I'm fine, you know.
Well, haven't you noticed that when you drink pop, you're thirstier than when you started?
Well, I haven't drank pop in a lot of years, so I'll have to take your word for it, Craig.
Nor have I, because I see what's happening. It's like the whole diabetes thing that's going on is, of course, people are getting diabetes when you see somebody drinking 44 ounces of pop, and that's only what they got for lunch, not including what they stopped by earlier and got. You're putting so many pounds of sugar in you, your body doesn't know how to react to all this.
Yeah, what I did notice, here's something, again, wandering slightly far afield, but not much, I don't think. I was down in Ohio a couple of years ago giving a speech, and I just was thirsty, right? And I went down and I bought a bottle of water from the vending machine, took it back up to the room, and I'm drinking this bottle of water, and as I'm drinking the water, I notice it's a perfectly normal sunny day, it's summer day, it wasn't, you know, hot, it was in the 70s. And I noticed, number one, I'm sweating, and number two, I'm thirstier than I was when I started drinking the water. And so I look in the water on the label, and it says it has potassium chloride added to it. So I go on the web, and I Google potassium chloride. Potassium chloride is the stuff that they shoot into the veins of people that they're giving lethal injections to. It stops their hearts in large quantities. In small quantities, it's an electrolyte. It's, you know, both potassium and, I believe it was potassium chloride, maybe it was potassium. Let's see. Salt is sodium chloride. Anyway, I have to look it up. I'm pretty sure that that's it. And it was like, you know, wow, what is this stuff? It's making me thirstier and thirstier. And I don't want to name the brand because I'm not sure that I have all you know, the name of the chemical right. But it's a, shall we say, a brand of water that comes from a major soft drink bottling company. And if anybody has any around the house, take a look at it and give me a call and let me know what's on the label there. Craig, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good point. Good point. Well said. Craig and Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I'm so glad you're discussing this subject because this also ties into how it's important for government to regulate industries, in particular the food industry. Yeah. Now, you've already touched on the high fructose corn syrup. There's another thing that I learned recently. You're familiar with hydrogenated oils.
Yes.
Well, what they did now is, if you notice on products, a lot of them say no trans fats, no trans fats. Well, what they're doing is, the law behind it is, if there's a minimal percentage of hydrogenated oils per serving, the food industry can claim that it has zero trans fats in it.
Interesting. Now, for our listeners who aren't necessarily familiar with what you're talking about, here's my, limited, like, you know, biology 101 understanding or biochem 101 of how this works. Basically, a fat molecule has what you could describe, a normal fat molecule has what you could describe as a whole lot of holes in it. It's sort of like a sponge floating around, and it can gather up into it other things. Things can be dissolved into it. And because of that, these, you know, normal oils and fats are liquid, you know, like olive oil, for example.
Right.
And what they discovered is, if you heat this stuff up to over 700 degrees and you bubble hydrogen through it, that those little tiny hydrogen atoms will fill the holes in the fat molecules and until they can't absorb anything else. And when you cool it back down again, it'll be solid instead of liquid. Thus, you have, you know, Crisco, you have those kinds of things, hydrogenated fats. And back in the 50s, everybody thought, isn't this cool? You know, hey, we figured out a way you don't have to deal with you know, wet stuff. You've got thick stuff. But then they discovered that these fats that are hydrogenated and heated like this, sometimes they're also referred to as trans fats. I'm sure that there's a fine distinction of some sort between hydrogenated fats and trans fats. But I believe that hydrogenated fats are a form of trans fats. Cause all kinds of problems, you know, heart disease, they may be implicated in cancer, things like this. And so what you're saying is that the government standards now say that if you're below a certain threshold, you can say there's none.
Exactly. And you got to remember, it's per serving. So, you know, even though to you it may seem, oh, that's a low amount, but if you count, well, if I'm eating four or five servings, you know, you're getting enough trans fats in your system to cause, you know, long-term damage.
Right, and then they play the servings game where they say, okay, serving size one cookie. Here's a bag with 70 cookies in it.
Right,
and
exactly.
And
also one more thing, Tom, is the other struggle has always been, if you know, with organic versus conventional fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. The food industry has always wanted to do this thing where they say, well, if there's a low amount of pesticides,
right,
you know, let's claim this as organic.
Right.
And so people have to really, I think, you know, for people out there who are not into politics, you have to pay attention, especially if you have children, because these things are really important and they're vital to the health of and the future of your children and yourselves.
Absolutely agree.
So, but that's how it ties into what you were saying earlier, Tom. We need to regulate the food industry to protect the public.
Yeah, well said. Thank you, Patricia. Thank you. And in fact, the reason why we do this, the reason why we create agencies like this and we empower them is because, you know, the cons are right when they say, you know, ultimately in a free market, we'll watch out for each other. You know, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, word would travel. I lived in a little town in Vermont. There was a bad doctor in town. Everybody knew it within a month. But we don't. Most of us don't live in little towns of 8,000 people like I did in Montpelier. You know, we live in big cities, and big cities we have to protect ourselves from the predators, anonymous predators like corporations. Jackie in Port Townsend. Hey, Jackie, we have about a minute before we have to take a break.
Hi, I was just thinking we could kill two birds with one stone, and this seems a little obvious in a way. We could solve the high rate of diabetes and our dependence on oil by redirecting the corn supply into ethanol and biodiesel products. The farmers can still sell their corn. We'd have a healthier population and a healthier earth. So it would just...
Well, they're doing that, actually. ADM now is running ads. We're now an energy company.
Well, we need to force the agribusiness corporate monster to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is pressure, you know, pressure in the marketplace, you know, demand pressure for biodiesel and for ethanol, and those things are, you know, a lot of those things are coming from corn. The problem that isn't addressed is the redirection away from corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, into these products.
Nobody wants corn syrup, that high fructose corn syrup, in actuality.
Yeah, well, I think the vast majority of people just don't know. They don't understand why they're getting fatter and fatter, and they're getting, you know, tired and out of breath and diabetic and waking up in the middle of the night and having to pee and all the symptoms of diabetes, early diabetes, and in kids even. They can't figure out that it has to do with corn syrup, maybe, in their food. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you join us, and the world.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Scott sends me a note here. He says, you said on the air today your blood is acid. He said, you said this in reference to nicotine absorption in the bloodstream. He says, you're incorrect. Your blood is base or alkaline. It should be 7.46 to 7.47. If it's more acidic than that, you probably have disease in your body. Cancer is flu and almost every other sickness survives in relatively acid blood. pH below 7.44. And low blood pH causes death. Interesting. I can't vouch for the accuracy of that, but sounds good. The point was that when the tobacco companies add ammonia to tobacco, they make the nicotine more alkaline than our blood. And the same thing with cocaine. When you freebase cocaine, you make it more alkaline than the blood, and that causes it to be very, very rapidly absorbed into the bloodstream and transported across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. But in any case, we strain at gnats. Larry Scott is with us with VAWatchdog.org, the nation's premier site, keeping track of the Veterans Administration. You guys watch the VA because somebody's got to do it, right, Larry?
That's exactly right, Tom. Welcome to Tom's chemistry class.
There you go. Yeah, now we've been talking about high fructose corn syrup and as free-based sugar and the obesity epidemic. You saw the news this morning that, mm-hmm. Over 2 million children have a disease that 30 years ago we never saw in people, virtually never saw in people under 40 years of age. And everybody's scratching their head going, why? And why is it happening in the United States and not in Europe?
And
in Europe, these kids are just as addicted to video games as they are here. And the simple answer is in Europe they use cane sugar. Here we use high fructose corn syrup,
right,
because we subsidize the corn companies. But that's a whole other thing. It's got nothing to do with the VA. Or maybe it does.
In a way it does, yes.
Okay.
And a matter of fact, the VA is having an incredible problem with obesity and late-onset diabetes.
Right.
They've started a number of new healthcare initiatives inside the VA to help veterans lose weight, eat a healthier diet, get an exercise program going. They say their number one health concern is obesity, and then that's followed by diabetes. And we're not necessarily talking about the diabetes here for those veterans who are exposed to Agent Orange. This is diabetes that's brought on by poor diet, and probably the high fructose corn syrup for all we know, and also lack of exercise.
Yeah,
they say it is a major healthcare problem in the veterans community.
I'm telling you, Larry, 3 years ago when I started doing this radio program, I was about the same time that I got sensitized to high fructose corn syrup, and I quit eating it. I quit eating it on the air, you know, and I lost weight. I immediately, over the course of 2 or 3 months, lost about 5 pounds, maybe a little bit more, which I needed to lose. I mean, it was getting a little bit of a spare tire there, and I felt better. And I just talked about it on the air, and I've had so many people call over the last 3 years saying that they've just taken high fructose corn syrup out of their diet and they lose weight. They just start losing weight. They still eat the same, you know, amount of food, same guy, whether they exercise or not, it doesn't seem to matter. This is the one huge variable, I think. You know, and so I've been kicking around the idea I should write a book on this. Anyhow, the VA's bad math again, underestimating post-traumatic stress disorder.
It's incredible, Tom. We're moving from chemistry class to math class now on this
there you
one.
Go.
And you and I had talked a few weeks ago about the VA's bad math and how they had miscalculated the number of GIs coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan who would be seeking VA health care benefits. They had estimated for this entire year about 120,000. More than 120,000 who sought health care in the first quarter of this fiscal year, and we had tossed around, that's about a 5-to-1 error factor. Well, guess what? Knight Ridder newspapers have gone in, who, by the way, cover the Veterans Administration marvelously, and they've looked at the PTSD cases now that are coming into the VA this year. The VA had estimated about 2,900 new cases. Guess what? It's going to be at least 5 times that amount. They're talking at least 15,000 veterans coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan who are going to be seeking VA health care for symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a very simple problem here. They're adding 1 plus 1 and they're getting 1. They're not realistically looking at the numbers. And my thought on this is it is really political pressure. They know they've only got so much money. So what they're saying is, well, okay, if we have this much money, we can take care of 2,900 people with PTSD. We're fine, Congress. We don't need any more.
Mm.
It's just political machinations. And you have to remember that Congress funds the VA health care system, and all of the higher-ranking positions in the VA are political appointees. They are not medical professionals. They are not business professionals.
They're bushies. They're bushistas.
Exactly right. They're brownies, if
yeah.
we can go there. And
they're doing a heck of a job.
Well, they're doing a terrible job when it comes to taking care of veterans. And the math is...
The VA should not be a political patronage. This shouldn't be a plum. You know, that's crazy.
It is absolutely crazy, but that's the way it works. There's a solution. We've talked about it before, and that is mandatory funding for VA health care, where we take these issues out of the hands of the political appointees and out of the hands of the politicians, and every year, through the House, through the Senate, this concept of let's mandatorily fund VA health care.
Right, make it essentially an entitlement rather than a budget item.
Right now, the health care portion of the VA budget is discretionary. Let's make it mandatory. We solve that problem, Tom.
And you can let your member of Congress know that that's what you think should happen.
Exactly right.
Great. Good on you. And you can call your member of Congress at 888-355-3588. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, and there's a lot more information on all kinds of stuff that's going on with the VA over at VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you again, Tom.
Good
Bye.
Talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Some folks have all learned to wave the flag, blue, red, white, and blue. But when the band plays Hail to the Chief, who's that point the cannon at you? It ain't me, it ain't me. I ain't no sinner, I stop. It ain't me, it ain't me. I ain't no fortune in rock.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Fortunate Son, by the way, my favorite biography of George W. Bush by Hatfield. The one that, Kitty Kelly's book, I think The Family, actually, is probably the best one out there. Welcome back to our program, 34 minutes past the hour. Our number 1-866-440-8466. 888-440-THOM. Our website, Tom Hartman, T-H-O-M, Hartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room or go participate in our message board, sort of a modified blog, as it were, everybody can participate. Anybody can post anything that they want and have a reasonable and rational discussion, hopefully. A few of them actually are a little unreasonable, but, you know, that's life. That's what goes on. Let's go back here. Karen in San Benito, California. Hey, Karen, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I've actually been taking a couple of notes here, so I hope you'll indulge me. And one of the things is there's a new buzzword out, actually, for all of the diabetes and the obesity, and that's called diabesity.
And it really is. It's these two conditions feeding each other.
It is. And also what I would like to touch on, because the more that I learn about this issue, the more incensed I get. Now, you were talking about the high fructose corn syrup. Well, 40% or more of the corn that we are eating is genetically modified.
Right.
And so is aspartame, is genetically modified. And you had a caller earlier who talked about being hungrier and thirstier. And actually, one of aspartame's traits is to be an appetite stimulant.
That's interesting. You know who you have to thank for aspartame?
Oh, Donald Rumsfeld.
There you go. He was president of CERL when they came out and they said, we'd like this to become a legal food additive. And the FDA initially turned it down because apparently it breaks down into formaldehyde.
Yeah.
If my recollection is correct, I may be wrong on that, but you know, some problem with it. And he had some pretty good connections, having been in the Ford administration, and so they decided to change their mind.
I know. Another thing I'll touch on quickly is you talked about hydrogenated fats and trans fats and things. And actually, one of the things that they're doing now is they're using palm oil and coconut oil, so that they can safely say that, well, we don't have any trans fats. But actually,
now, aren't palm oils and coconut oils supposed to be good for you?
Actually, they're saturated fats.
I understand that, but I've read a couple of articles in, like, you know, health magazines and whatnot, saying that even though these are saturated fats, that there is a certain amount of saturated fat that you actually need.
Well, whenever you eat any kind of an oil or a fat, it's not necessarily the best for you. I mean, we need some natural oils, but I know that saturated fats in the palm oil and the coconut oil, that when you get too many of those too, that they could have the exact effects that trans fat does.
Yeah, I think the too many is the part, but it's so hard. Yeah, it's so hard to sort it all out because there is all this information coming from the food industry on the one hand, and then you've got, you know, some reasonable researchers out there, but an awful lot of people are not revealing the agendas that they're associated with.
Well, plus the fact that I was in Costco the other day, and I went to buy a Orville Redenbacher popcorn, and I looked, and it was looking like a good deal, so they had a telephone number up there, and I called them up to say, okay, now is this GM corn? And I was put on hold for a second, and the woman came back on, and she told me, well, actually, since we know that genetically modified foods are kind of controversial, we'll take into account your comments, and thank you very much for calling. And I was like, wait a minute, you mean to tell me that you actually are not going to answer my question?
Well, that's interesting. At least they answered the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm impressed by that, but...
Well, she put me through. It took me another 15 minutes of waiting to get to another woman who also made kind of a disclaimer and then told me that they soon would be making an organic popcorn. And I think that not enough people really understand, and I'd like to challenge your listeners to go and look at some of the foods that they've got in their shelves and to call those numbers and ask if they're genetically modified, because right now over 85% of soy, 76% of cotton, 75% of canola, over 40% of corn, more than 50% of Hawaiian papaya, some small amounts of zucchini, yellow squash, and Quest tobacco are all GM. And as far as corn syrup goes, it is a derivative from corn. And we've got dextrose, maltodextrin, fructose. And I got a lot of this information from seedsofdeception.com, where you can get... You can join and you can get a couple of DVDs because our kids are definitely at risk. And right now, I think it's such an important time for people to really become more aware.
Yeah.
And they're not eating this kind of food over in Europe.
Yeah.
Not
no,
as much.
Having lived in Europe for a year, and I spent a lot of time there, I can tell you, you're absolutely right, Karen. There, you know, fresh food and, you know, local farmers and a big emphasis on that. Karen, I've got to move along. Thank you for the good point you made. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Louise just popped me a note here saying that she was told that some palm oils are unregulated. A particular health food store that she shops at says, we're just not even going to carry this stuff because they're unregulated and they contain too many pesticides. That's interesting. You learn something new every day. Jackie in Seattle. Hey, Jackie, what's on your mind?
Hi. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Jackie?
Hey, I was calling. I was listening to your program this morning and regarding... I turned in just as you were talking about corn in a little village in Mexico and
mm-hmm.
how it costs more money for the people there to buy corn than it did to have it shipped in from the United States. And this goes along also with your caller who was just on before me. And when I called and talked to your producer, there's a movie that's out on the shelves. Was put out last year in 2005, a documentary called The Future of Food.
I've seen it.
Yeah, and I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's a great film, and it talks about genetically engineered food, especially corn and canola and everything. And if people want to go to thefutureoffood.com, they can get more information about that.
Great. Jackie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Alan says he has some information on coconut oil. This is turning into a food show. I've never done a food show. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Not much. I was just making a batch of soy yogurt and heard the conversation. Again, it's whether or not oils are hydrogenated.
Right.
And
you mean as in heated up to 700 degrees and having hydrogen bubble through them? Or
exactly. Coconut oil, you can spend a little bit more. I buy through Azure Standard, and
mm-hmm.
I get organic Philippine coconut oil that they let ret. They separate it and let it kind of stew, and the oil will, of course, rise.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, Azure is great. I get dried blueberries from them that I put into my oatmeal every morning. I put some oatmeal in water and fresh almonds and dried blueberries in a bowl and let it sit overnight, and that's what I have for breakfast. And I get all the nuts and everything else I put in there from Azure Standard, through the web. And you know,
yeah, exactly. I
great
buy
prices.
About once a month.
Yeah, buy it in bulk. I've got 25 pounds of lentils sitting downstairs in case the bird flu comes.
Well, I don't know about the bird flu, but I get a little sketchy walking through. I work in supermarkets. I do refrigeration, and
uh-huh.
I can't hardly stand working in them. They are not healthy, and anybody in the back end of a supermarket that tells you otherwise is doing his job.
Yeah, the food coming in sprayed with the chemicals to make things look fresh.
They're fish. I wouldn't buy fish.
And the fungicides and
flash frozen, and most of their meat is saved with CO2 or carbon monoxide now to keep
carbon monoxide,
colors.
Yeah, to keep it pink.
Yeah, something foul.
Yeah, it's that stuff that you're not supposed to breathe coming out of the back end of your car unless you want to commit suicide.
Toxic.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
Have fun, man.
It is. No, carbon monoxide is toxic. Having it in your food theoretically is such a small quantity, but it's not toxic because what it does is it ties up hemoglobin in the blood. You know, for much longer than oxygen normally does. The body thinks it's oxygen and, you know, tries to transport it, but then the hemoglobin doesn't release it the way it does oxygen, and so it ends up basically, you know, suffocating a person. But, you know, which is why they put it into meats and fish in the meat area is because it ties up those red blood cells and keeps them red. They don't release
red.
The oxygen and turn brown, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't oxidize. Yep. Alan, thanks for the call. Great to hear
Bye.
From you. I appreciate it. Jack in Eureka, California. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind today?
Donald Rumsfeld and the pharmaceutical connection.
Okay. You're talking
previous,
about Tamiflu. His
previous caller just mentioned aspartame. He was CEO of that company, Cyril, at one point.
Yep.
And he was also CEO of a biotech called Gilead 10 years ago,
which owns the patent, that's being exercised.
Yep. And sold the rights for marketing and sale to Roche, who just recently put together $2 billion worth of Tamiflu to the United States, to the government.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how he's got his hand in everything, and you know, that there's pros and cons about whether Tamiflu, whether avian flu is really an epidemic in the making or not.
Yeah.
It's been around for 10 years. The first human got in Vietnam got avian flu over 10 years ago, and there's been less than 100 deaths worldwide in the past 10 years.
Well, I think the larger debate is because there is a consensus that this may represent, you know, this type of flu may represent a potential problem. The larger debate is whether Tamiflu is a reasonable remedy for it. And the reality is, that in all probability, we won't know until or if the flu happens.
Well, there's a British study that was done with Tamiflu suggests it's not really good for any of the flus, in as good as others that are out there on the market.
Yeah, and there's a number of, I think a couple of them are generic now, the antivirals. Yeah. Jack, thanks for the call and for the heads
You're
up.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. 45 minutes, I'm sorry, Jack, we're out of time. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back, friends.
Light me up yourself, and don't be no drag. Light me up yourself, because this is the other day.
It's a beautiful day, isn't it? I mean, no matter what the weather's like, if we're breathing, it's a beautiful day. Another, excuse me. No, it's another day. On we go. Our program. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. You can get the latest iPods now, as well as all things Macintosh, all things computer, really, at Small Dog Electronics. And smalldog.com, of course, their website, 1-866-440-8466. And Sharon in Kamano Island. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. One last thing on oils, and I know this is not a food show, but...
I'm fascinated by it, and apparently our listeners are, too. So we'll ride this for another few minutes.
Cottonseed oil is in almost all the bread and baked goods that you see on the shelves because it's so cheap. But did you know that cotton is not classified as a food, and therefore it's not regulated by the FDA? And cotton crops are the most pesticide-treated of any crop in the world, and the oil is very bad for you, but you're getting it in most everything because it's cheap. I always ask the bakers at my local grocery stores and stuff to please, you know, not use cottonseed oil. Of course, you know, they don't care, but at least that they know how bad it is.
Sure, get the word out.
You'd be amazed. If you pick up any baked good in any store on any shelf, you will see cottonseed oil as one of the main ingredients.
And when was the last time you saw a person sitting around going, gee, I think I'll eat some cotton?
Right, right. And, I mean, I won't even wear cotton that's not organic because it has so many pesticides in it. Cotton is very bad, but that's a whole other show. One last thing, coconut oil, virgin, extra virgin, organic is absolutely good for you. It's been given a bad rap. Read the coconut diet and all of those.
That's what I thought. You know, I thought it was good.
I am living on coconut oil, and I tell you what, eggs scrambled in coconut oil are wonderful, and popcorn popped in coconut oil the regular old-fashioned way is to die for.
Yeah, but apparently there is also coconut oil in the market that has been hydrogenated. It's processed.
Yes, but you don't want that. I get mine online from Tropical, you know, I don't need to name the brand, but it comes straight from the Philippines, too, and it's an absolutely, you know, organic, fresh coconut.
Yeah,
but anyway, coconut oil got a bad rap, mainly starting with margarine companies and all of those that wanted to destroy it. But good coconut oil is very good for you.
Okay, great. And thank you, Sharon. And
thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. And following on this topic, Susan in South Egremont, Massachusetts, has some thoughts on this. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Tom. So good to talk to you. I just wanted to let you know, let your listeners know, Arthur Agaston, the doctor from Florida with the South Beach Diet,
mm-hmm.
is also very much down on the high fructose corn syrup,
right?
For just the reasons that you've cited.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've
and it's in everything.
Well, not everything, because I do not eat it.
Well,
I have managed to avoid it.
The average person, it's in everything. It's in ketchup. It's in, you know, chili. It's amazing.
Yeah, virtually all processed foods. And you're right. Ketchup is very, very high in it. In fact, you know, on those rare occasions where I'm in a restaurant and I'm actually eating ketchup, I know I'm eating corn syrup, and I notice it afterwards.
Yes, you do.
I just, you know, it whacks me.
Well, I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Okay. Thanks
okay,
a lot,
thanks.
Susan.
Thanks.
Great to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks for listening to us there. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, people need to just, you know, read the labels, make your own food, definitely stay away from the high fructose corn syrup, because I read a medical journal article once that stated since after 1976 they replaced sugar with high fructose corn syrup and diabetes went through the ceiling.
Yeah, what year was that?
1976.
76. Do you know what year Coke changed their formula?
I think it was in 1976.
Yeah.
Because they mentioned it certain products and Coke was one of them.
Yeah, I think it was later than that, because I'm pretty sure it happened when we were living in Atlanta, and we moved to Atlanta in 83.
Wow.
But I could be wrong. It could be that it happened before we moved there, and I was just hearing the, you know, because Atlanta is Coke City, you know, and it's a big hoop-de-doop there. So.
Hey, and one more point about coconut oil.
Sure.
It's the medium-chain fatty acids, which are contained in coconut butter or coconut oil, is our body actually metabolizes it and converts it to energy.
And needs those. Some of those things are actually like lubricants for the joints and things, too,
exactly.
To hyper-simplify. Yeah.
And that's just one, I mean, because the Polynesian tribes, you know, swear by it.
Yeah.
But one quick point about the oil companies, maybe you could do a show hyper-focusing on the patents that these greedy oil companies have been sitting on for like the last 150 years.
How do you sit on a patent for 150 years? You're talking about patents for the technology of fracturing things?
Yeah, free energy, you know, you name it. You know, that's non-petroleum.
Oh, the ones that
technology.
They pulled off the market, the Stirling engine and things like that?
Yeah, because nobody's talking about it. We're all talking about and focusing on the price gouging when there's so much newer technologies that the oil companies hope we don't start demanding that.
Well, if there's an upside to $5 a gallon gas, and I really think that we're going to have $5 a gallon gas within 12 to 15 months.
My God, I mean, we have the whole gravitational field to draw energy from, let alone, you know, other sources, you know.
Yeah, talk to Nikola Tesla. I mean, you can't talk to him now, but I mean, you can go back and look at some of the work that he did. But if there's an upside to it, it's that I don't think that anybody's going to be able to suppress energy efficient systems any longer. I think it's all going to come out. David, I got to move along. Sue in Tulalip, Washington.
Tulalip.
Thank you, Sue. We have about a minute left. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to mention that FEMA has closed its office in New Orleans.
You're right. It's in my stack of stuff to talk about today, and I didn't get to it. And how ironic is that?
I can't believe it.
It is absolutely incredible. They just closed the door.
Toxic policy decision.
Yep, there you go. Another
take
great
care, Tom.
Thank you
for your sharpness.
Thank you. You too, Sue, and thanks for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle. And, you know, another great policy victory for the Bushies. They've closed the FEMA office in New Orleans. Coming up on tomorrow's program, conservative Yaron Brook claims Exxon chairman deserves $400 million. Yeah, that and Mike DeWine, excuse me, not Mike DeWine, Sherrod Brown is going to be with us, running against Mike DeWine, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.